If we're going with 10 episode seasons, this would be 206.
Okay. We just divided our season in half.
Yeah, we just did exactly what Prodigy did.
Yeah, yeah.
For everybody who's listening, welcome back to our Story Trek podcast. And as usual, it's myself, Michael Stridiakis.
And Marshall Hopkins.
Looking at and talking about the narratives within the Star Trek universe. This time, I think it's clear to say, Marshall, that we are going to have to delve into the latest and greatest Trek series, Strange New Worlds.
Absolutely. It is the freshman on the block. It hit with a bang in the history of Rotten Tomatoes and Star Trek. If I recall correctly, this one had a 100% fresh rating on the tomato meter, I think, for its first couple of episodes or first couple of weeks out. I don't know if any other Star Trek produced item or entity has done that. Yeah, we've got to discuss that. We've got to discuss some of the storytelling that we have observed in it. Let's talk about how Strange New Worlds approaches the Trek that we know from a completely new perspective, new budgetary, new costume, new setting profile, and of course, the stories that we liked and maybe have a few notes on.
You know, one of the interesting things about Strange New Worlds, and we've talked about in previous episodes regarding series-long arcs, series-long narratives, and episodic formatting. Strange New Worlds seems to take a page out of more modern television with the development of its characters and has some season-long arcs. But what's been interesting is sort of the reintroduction of that single-episode narrative structure.
Which I have desperately missed. I mean, listen, we know that we're in the world and era of streaming and binge-watching and all of that. It is refreshing to not have to watch 2 hours to get the gist of our, you know, three or four.
It's far too long. We're watching television, at least in Trek today, or some Marvel series or Star Wars series or whatever it is today. And you'll often find you're waiting. You're like, well, let's see where this goes. You're like three or four episodes in, and you know it's going to be like an 8 to 10 episode season. And you're maybe on the fence about something. Maybe you're excited about it. And then you get to that second half of the season. You either get really excited about it or you get really disappointed about it. And that overall tone of the season really affects how I enjoy the show. Whereas, you know, if you go back even to the Deep Space Nine era for Trek for myself, it's like, okay, the season overall might have had more dud episodes than great episodes, but those great episodes you can go back and watch again because they're not tied to so much of the things that you disliked about maybe one or two episodes that were duds.
And I will say this, I always expect the first season of any show to have at least one or two clunkers, to be kind. And I think every Star Trek show has had at least one or two. I will say Strange New Worlds are, if they have any, it's arguable. I would argue that there's at least one. You may be shocked at that one. But I do think that this is overall just an excellent production. Everybody involved in this seems to have gone forward with this with love of Trek and an attempt to kind of bring these characters forward. There are many times where Anson Mount's character does something or says something in a way that really evokes Jeffrey Hunter from The Cage. And you can... And it seems like you've seen that actor play different things within his role as Pike in different ways. So you can tell that if you are familiar with that, and if you've watched Jeffrey Hunter in The Cage as many times as, you know, a Trek fan might, you're familiar with that gesture. You're familiar with that look or the way he delivered the line as a reference to this. So I feel like every single performer here is kind of doing something, you know, they're bringing their own to a character we already know. And kudos to the writers and producers and the performers for creating that framework for them to deal with the characters as established, but also allow them to flourish as performers and, you know, take it in a different way.
One of the biggest concerns that myself, and I think Marshall, you had this as well, going into Strange New Worlds, was regarding the character of Lan Nguyen Singh.
Yep.
That was a character that seemed to be playing a lot of fan service, given the connection that she obviously has to Khan Noonien Singh, and that we were going to get some sort of additional Khan backstory that we didn't know that we wanted. So far, I'd have to say within the first season, they have not done anything beyond just simply introducing her character as a descendant of Khan to warrant a groan from me. They've literally like, she's Khan Noonien Singh related, and that's that. It seems that they've imbued her character actually with a lot more backstory that's related to her and not her family legacy, which I'm very thankful for. It was a really like softball type of thing if they were just simply going to create her entire character being, you know, somehow affected by her relationship with the nefarious Khan. And so far, one season in, they have managed to surprise me as far as the writing is concerned. And I think that Christina Chong is a fantastic actress. I look forward to seeing what else she does outside of Trek, just to kind of see what range she brings to things. But I will say that in the course of the 10 episodes we got out of the first season, she displayed a range within the bounds of the story that was a little surprising to me, even from the perspective of what we got her character was through the first two or three episodes.
Yeah.
When you get to the Elysian Kingdom episode, you obviously see her playing a role completely out of character. It's a role that's out of character for her, but she handles it as if that's what she normally gets hired to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought was really impressive about her work there, especially like just kind of bringing a lightheartedness and comedic touch to everything without going over the top. And Quality of Mercy, just showing her character, the same one we'd seen at the beginning of the season, who's been very cautious and very reserved and measured in her approaches to everything. And she's had some evolution along the way, particularly with her connection with Una. Mm-hmm. But seeing her at the end of the season in this alternative timeline presented, where her character, you know, is more relaxed, not comedic, but just a different vibe. Mm-hmm. It really shows the breadth of not only just the what they're planning to do with the character, but a breadth of what Christina is able to bring to the character. And that's the role that I think has been most surprising to me.
I 100% agree. I could not agree more. I think that she's, I will go further. I think that she's a breath of fresh air. And this is a show whose cast is not filled with slouches. This is an excellent cast for any series that you're producing on television, much less Star Trek. She commands the screen in almost every scene that she's in, even when she's playing the princess in the Elysian Kingdom. She is captivating. And it's weird to say, because it's no disrespect to Strange New Worlds. She's so good, I can't wait to see her in other things. Because again, she has displayed an incredible range that you rarely see in many performers. And as you mentioned before, she seems to be able to go from the Khan character that we know. And just as an aside, mentioning that totally won us over, you know, one of the few things we went into the show with doubts about, totally won us both over, and we're singing her praises. Now I do want to see an episode exploring her backstory, which is something I would have said, you know, maybe 6 months ago, don't do that. And it's on the strength of the performer and the writing. She's excellent and brilliant. I think we said, as we were, you know, exchanging our chats and messages as we were watching the series, you know, it's like, how did, you know, Marvel not snap her up? How did other top dollar franchises not get her? And again, not to disrespect Strange New Worlds, not to disrespect Star Trek. It's simply that she displays an uncommon ability and range for, I think she's only, what, 26, 27?
Something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Uncommon ability and range that just makes every moment that she's on the screen pop. You look for La'an. So the episode where you see her restraint in this kind of icy exterior, her armor, begin to melt, and seeing that process, her relationship and her performances with Rebecca Romijn, also, absolutely brilliant work. I can't say enough about Christina Chong. I'm excited about her in the next season. If I can add no further praise, it's this. As it was when I saw Brent Spiner in season one of TNG, or Rene Auberjonois in season one of Deep Space Nine, I want to see more of La'an Noonien Singh and know where this person comes from. And just as it was with both of them, with Spiner and Auberjonois, a lot of it, for me, at least 45 to 50% of it, if not more, is the strength of the performance.
On paper, if you were just to like look at that and think within the boundaries of what seemed to be framed up, it's a character that could easily have turned into Tasha Yar.
Right.
And I think the strength of Christina's performances and her chemistry, or in the right way, lack of chemistry with some characters, is what makes her so compelling to watch. And I'm really interested to see where she takes it season two. One character I think that I will say that I am on the concern side with still, having now seen season one, is the portrayal of Captain Kirk.
Yeah, the problem with the new Kirk. Oh, boy.
I know we were supposed to see Kirk at some point and we figured it would be season two, but turns out it was the finale of season one. And I understand the context in which they brought him in, so I'm not upset about that or feel like, oh, you can't bring Kirk into this. What are you doing?
Right.
The scenes, the lines. I have other issues with that episode that are weird choices to make with characters we have established in Strange New Worlds, like specifically with Ortegas, which I love her character in general. And then what they did with her character in this episode, I'm just not a fan of. But that's something I'll get to in a little bit. The main thing, though, is Kirk. We've seen Chris Pine play Kirk. We've seen William Shatner play Kirk, and they're definitely different performances, but they're both based and inspired by Horatio Hornblower. Mm-hmm. And they're both played for adventure. They're both played as charismatic roles and leaders. Strange New Worlds decides to make Kirk a risk taker, but seems to ignore those other characteristics which made James T. Kirk the iconic character that he's been. I don't know what to say and where the line is drawn with this, if this was an intentional thing by Henry Alonzo Myers, one of the showrunners, since I know he wrote Quality of Mercy, or if this version of Kirk, always forgetting the name of this actor now.
Paul Wesley.
Yeah, I mean, the guy with two first names. I actually, isn't Paul Wesley the name of some like throwaway character name on TNG?
Oh,
That's why every time I hear his name, I think of some TNG throwaway episode from like season two or one.
Maybe it was like one of the engineers before Geordi or something. I don't know.
My brain is going to Arsenal of Freedom. The character that Riker knows, that's the guy on the planet. Paul, the guy's name is Paul, I think, right?
Yeah, let me see. I'm looking
at it. I'm sorry. It's just the name. I'm just like, why do I keep associating him with TNG?
USS Drake.
Paul Rice.
Paul,
so there
Rice.
Is a Paul. And then I guess Wesley, just Wesley Crusher. I haven't seen his other work. Mm-hmm. So I know there's people who are like, oh, you know, he's great in these other shows or whatever. I'm like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to give him sort of a second chance. Mm-hmm. But in one episode, the things that his character seems to be lacking don't seem to be things that you just turn on or off. I feel like these are things that you either have or you don't have. When Anson Mount walked onto the bridge or beamed on board Discovery for the first time, you knew this guy had charisma from the minute he stepped off that transporter pad.
Exactly.
I had not seen anything Anson Mount had done up until that point. That was the first time I ever laid my eyes on Anson Mount as a guest star on Discovery. And I knew that this guy had charisma. And not only did he show that he did, but it was enough that it warranted a new show. Partly part of why.
Right.
But when you look at like Michelle Yeoh and her role as Emperor Georgiou in Discovery, you understand why they'd want to do a show with Georgiou and why they've talked about a Section 31 show with her so far at this point. Remains to be seen if they do it. But with Paul Wesley, he beams on board the Enterprise. We see him on the Farragut, and in either place I feel like his mannerisms, his body, facial structure, everything doesn't say Kirk. It says Jim Carrey playing Kirk. And I know that's been put out there a lot, but it's like, he's not doing the Jim Carrey impression of William Shatner.
Right.
He just looks more like Jim Carrey playing a role. Jim Carrey's a funny man when he's put in the right position as an actor.
Right.
Jim Carrey's a pretty damn good actor overall.
Yeah.
The thing about Jim Carrey is that Jim Carrey is not necessarily going to be this charismatic character. He's going to be entertaining. He's going to be dramatic. He's going to be interesting, but I don't see him being charismatic. And when I look at Paul Wesley, I think he's more Jim Carrey than he is William Shatner or Chris Pine. I want him to prove me wrong so bad. Like I said, we started this talking about singing praises about how wrong we were about Lon. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as a character, they could certainly go off and, you know, torpedo that down the future just by deciding to go hard into the con background. But the actress makes that role work. The role of Kirk in the case of what they present in A Quality of Mercy is a role of Kirk that we have seen before. Mm-hmm. So we have something to compare it to. And when you put side by side, it doesn't add up. We're not even in the ballpark. This is like somebody you may have auditioned for Kirk and you went, well, that's interesting. It's different. If your main concern was don't upstage Anson Mount, then you nailed it. He literally feels like a wet blanket character brought in. And I hope Paul Wesley is a fantastic actor and other things that he does. But in this role, he's not right for it.
Well, I have a few thoughts on him, and I'm kind of not dissimilar to yours. I do, and I'll add two caveats up front. Because it took place in an alternate timeline of the events of Balance of Terror, I can accept that may not be the final form Jim Kirk that we're expected to see. Number two, I have also never seen Paul Wesley in anything else. I've been told that also he's a great actor. So I have to assume that this was an intentional choice. And I think he said in interviews, I didn't want to do Shatnerism. And that's perfectly fine. But as you mentioned, there's more to playing Kirk than the Shatnerisms that Pine nailed it. And Shatner obviously invented it. You call it the Horatio Hornblower thing. I call it just exuberance. Like, no matter what Kirk is doing, he is really, really, really friggin' excited to be working in space. Right, like every moment, even in Trouble with Tribbles, it's his dream job. And when you see Paul Wesley in A Quality of Mercy, it just looks like, yeah, I'm just here. I'm just doing this. You know, he does not look like, and no matter what the circumstances are, whether Kirk is in war or if he's in peacetime, no matter what the circumstances are, it was always played as if this is the best job in the galaxy. You know, the only time it wasn't played like that was intentionally in Star Trek Beyond, where Kirk is considering leaving that role. And again, these are intentional choices for the actor. So my issue with Paul Wesley's Kirk is that he doesn't really seem to care. And I don't mean doesn't seem to care as an actor. I mean the character Kirk doesn't really seem to care. And if there's anything that Kirk is, he's a guy that cares about two things overall: his ship and his crew, number one, and number two, interchangeably. And not even in the writing of his character did he express a great deal of concern about his ship and his crew. His ship was destroyed. Members of his crew were dead because of a call that Pike made. Now, he calls Pike out on the decision not to engage in a conflict with an unknown enemy, as we later discover, is a Romulan ship. But he mentions nothing about his ship or his crew. That was the number one most incongruous thing with the character Kirk, beyond Shatner's pauses, beyond the whatever else you associate with it. So I think that was the number one criticism I had, is that, well, this guy doesn't seem to really care. He's just there. I'm just doing this thing.
We've got his brother Sam serving on the Enterprise. Pike calls him to sit down and talk with him about, like, tell me about your brother. And I don't know why we needed to have that. He was talking about his brother as if his brother is some alien race, and I've got to figure out. It's like he's another starship captain. Do you have to call in somebody's relative just so that you know how this person behaves?
Right.
It felt weird because it felt like it was for the audience. Let us tell you in a very telegraphed manner who Kirk is. Let me have his brother sit down and describe him to you. It just doesn't feel right. The whole setup of it, what he even says about a brother, doesn't even sound like his brother saying it. It sounds like a writer trying to inject characteristics that you were hoping that Paul Wesley will imbue.
A lot of their decisions in regards to this episode felt just off, especially when it came to Kirk. But there's also the decision with Ortegas. And I want to first off say, in every single episode of this show, this performer, Melissa Navia, I didn't want to mispronounce it. Melissa Navia has been absolutely excellent. Again, another breath of fresh air. Another, like, really a heavy hitter in a roster of heavy hitters of performers on this show. I can't think of too many other characters who are consistently the comic relief without sacrificing any bit of the ability to convey dramatic gravitas when necessary. She does the smart aleck very well, excellently performed, but it's also not done to the expense of others. You know, it's not a quip thing. It's not a put down contest. She brings a lot of character to a character that we don't really know a lot about. Like, let's count what we know about Ortegas. She pilots the ship. That's it.
Actually, Melissa had something to say the other day at Star Trek Day, that is the time of this recording is within a week of that, where they actually introduced a scene from season two, demonstrate that there is going to be a Ortegas driven episode in season two. And there was an acknowledgement that there was not one in season one.
She is just a brilliant performer. And now we get to Equality of Mercy. And there's something that's just really off to me. It's not at all her performance. It's the way the character is presented and written. So this episode takes place some, was it 8 or 10 years after the show Strange New Worlds is typically set?
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. But it's set in the original series episode Balance of Terror. And for various, well, it's never really explained. Inexplicably, Ortegas has become a bigot, it seems. Mm-hmm. This bigotry comes out of nowhere. It doesn't appear to have any connection with the character that we know. And then the thing that sticks in my craw is that after 8 to 10 years of hardship, you can become a bigot. Sure, maybe some people, that is true. But I have a hard time believing that we go from the Ortegas we see in the timeline of Strange New Worlds to the Ortegas we see in this alternate universe Balance of Terror, Equality of Mercy, and say, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. It seemed unearned and uninformed just to fit Ortegas into the role of Styles, I think it was, yeah, in Balance of Terror, who was a bigot, who was presented as that, who was presented as he lost his relatives in the previous Romulan War, and he was angry because of that. His bigotry was informed, and it played with the character. Just slapping Ortegas there just feels completely out of left field.
Ortegas prides herself on being a ship's helmsman, the pilot. And all of a sudden, now she's the navigator.
Yeah.
We want so hardcore for the navigator in this episode to be this bigot that we're going to move Ortegas into this role. So not only have we taken away one of the things that she's very proud of that we've seen in her character and excited about and talented about, but we've changed her role and somewhat of a, not necessarily a demotion, just a sidestep, which is really odd. And now she's bigoted. It just seems like there was too much emphasis on trying to wedge her character into a preordained role.
Right. It wasn't her performance. It was, this isn't the Ortegas that has been established that I know. So this is jarring to me.
As you pointed out, Styles was set up as having a background that even explained the bigotry itself. His brashness was also explained by his youth. He was obviously a guest star. So you know what? After this, you don't like this character. That's fine. He's gone.
Right.
But the main thing here about that last episode, Quality of Mercy, just to sort of put a button on it, is it makes sense that it finishes that arc that we established with Anson Mount's character of Pike. The beginning of the season, he's really questioning his role and his future and, you know, his quote unquote destiny of basically living a life of hell trapped inside a body in a wheelchair, essentially, and, you know, accepting his fate by the end of the season. And it was a great arc. I really enjoyed it. I think that was played very well. And I think that the execution of it and the choice to do it this way was well worth it. And that's the thing I think that's disappointing about Quality of Mercy is like, oh, you guys got so many things right about it. Then we've got the weird casting of Kirk and we got the Ortegas matter.
The one last thing I wanted to add about Quality of Mercy, and I really think it's really kind of a metaphor for Quality of Mercy, but we're going to have just a little of a geek out moment. The Monster Maroon. Now, the Monster Maroon, I love that it's there. I love seeing it. Looking closer at it, there's some really weird choices made in it. And I feel like that is kind of a metaphor for that episode. I love that you're touching on Balance of Terror. I love that you're attempting this. I love that you're bringing Pike's arc to a close. But there are some really weird choices made within it that are kind of questionable.
I would have been completely in favor of just bringing the Monster Maroon back as is. I mean, it's like the Constitution refit Enterprise to me. You can't design a starship any better than that. That looks like Starfleet. You cannot design a Starfleet uniform that's going to say Starfleet as much as that Monster Maroon does. I think that touches on something else about the season of Strange New Worlds, but I just wanted to say the importance of the Coast Guard military-like protocols within Trek that have been in there forever. And this is not just a Strange New Worlds thing. This is an overall Trek thing. Seem to have really gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
And I feel like you used to hear on Trek, somebody walks up to Picard and really wants to say something important to him. before they did, they actually went through just simply saying permission to speak freely, sir. It showed that there was a structure and then there was a regiment to this within the Trek world. Right. There were rules that these characters followed. Right now, it feels like on every Trek series, you're holding the ideals of Starfleet. And it feels like Starfleet has become this embodiment of what humanity is in the future. And it seems like that's almost a reinterpretation of things. Starfleet was a vessel for the interpretation of the future as opposed to the idol of the future. The idolization of the future, to me, has always just been humanity itself, has always been right. The Federation. To make this real obsession with the Delta and we are Starfleet, it feels like a lot of rah-rah without the without the sort of the detail.
Right.
And this is just a general criticism I have of these sayings, is it just doesn't feel right. Like the whole we are Starfleet, it doesn't really work for me. You know, they always say show, don't tell. I feel like show me what Starfleet is. Don't tell me that you're Starfleet.
Right. I would love to have an episode where an alien race just says, well, what does that mean? How am I supposed to know who you are?
Yeah, we're Starfleet. We don't lie. I mean, I think that's some line that Wesley says. Everybody and their dog probably laughed at that line at the time. Yeah. But if you had a character on one of the news shows say that, I think somebody today would go, yeah.
Yeah.
To now Starfleet has been made into the actual idealization. But what is Starfleet? It's just like it's these weird nebulous ideas. And it's when it's supposed to be an organization, like an organization has rules, protocols. Yes, it has ideals and culture, but I want to see the ideals and culture. If you're part of something, you just are that way. And yes, you identify yourself as Starfleet when somebody asks who you are, but you don't just volunteer it.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Starfleet. Okay. I didn't ask.
Yeah. We're from Starfleet. Okay.
Coolsies. It's this idea that the symbol should carry as much weight and meaning as what it's supposed to symbolize, is what it symbolizes. The truth of the matter is that the symbol carries the weight. We don't need to do any of the heavy lifting. The symbol is carrying the weight. It's carrying the iconography of Star Trek. All you need to do is see the Delta. You think Shatner, you think Nimoy, you think Stewart and Frakes and Spiner and so many others. You think, you know, it seems that it's kind of this branding thing where we are Starfleet becomes this slogan that you can carry anywhere. And then as soon as someone starts to ask, well, what does that mean? You know, you have to point them in the direction of classic Star Trek episodes that will explain it to them. Well, why isn't anyone doing that now? You know, I would love for them to meet an alien race that says, I don't know who you are. I don't know what that means. And just because you saved the day here doesn't mean I have any idea what your culture or values are.
I mean, that does get a little bit touched on. Children of the Comet. That's an episode I thought that actually really does show more than tell with regards to that. So Marshall, what was your favorite episode of season one?
Actually, I have two favorite episodes, and it was kind of a 1-2 punch that really gives you, I felt like, the best of what Strange New Worlds had to offer. I felt like it was the best of what modern Trek has to offer. And you get two different flavors of kind of the 60 Trek in both of these. Episode 4, Memento Mori, which was written by David Perez and Bo DeMeo. And then Spock Amok, which was written by Henry Alonzo Myers and Robin Wasserman. First in Memento Mori, you get this, and I know I've mentioned off camera, I love the Trek submarine drama style, action type of stories. And it had been a long time since we've seen an episode where, and I know we discussed this privately, an episode where there's been a disaster. Members of the crew are separated in different compartments and have to work together to solve an issue. You get all of the above in Memento Mori. All of that is just some excellent drama that's played brilliantly. And I'm not even at the mountaintop of my praise for this episode. But in short, the Enterprise is, to give you an idea of the episode, the Enterprise is lured into a trap that has been set by the Gorn, a race that we have not seen since Arena in the 1960s. If you have ever heard or even Googled an image of Star Trek, at some point you have come across the green lizard man in the obviously rubber costume. The reason I'm going off on and talking about this episode of Memento Mori is because you never see these creatures, not once, and yet they become terrifying and horrifying. There's a lot of intellectual property, out there. There are a lot of things that are based on previous shows or books or comic books or previous shows of shows or previous movies or cartoons or now board games. But if you can take from what I already know, from what is established, and instead of just give me more of what I can expect, but give me something that I don't expect or advance or take me someplace that I wasn't expecting to go, then that is good use of that intellectual property. You should use what's there as a platform for not just good storytelling. You can branch off into, you know, the lore of the story, whatever. This does all of the above. Well, we never see the Gorn, but we learn that they are hunters. We learn how they attack other ships. We learn many of their practices. And then most of all, at the top of that mountain is Christina Chong's performance as La'an. We find out that as a child or as a adolescent, her ship that she was a refugee on was captured by the Gorn. She saw members of her ship and her family one by one kept alive, only as sort of cattle, and then slowly were killed. And she eventually escaped at the cost of the life of a loved one. And so Christina Chong's performance throughout this, and if I recall the Ready Room episode with Will Wheaton, who does an excellent job on those, I think he was talking to Davy Perez about Memento Mori, and they were discussing how, and with I think with Christina Chong as well, about how post-trauma and I think post-traumatic stress represented in her and how it exemplified in her performance as La in different ways and in different moments. And I just felt that it was an excellent drama all the way around. You even got a little bit of a medical drama moment. So you got Star Trek ER or whatever you like. But, you know, you still got a little bit of ER moment or doctor's. I felt that Memento Mori was great. Bacca Muck was just fun. It's simply fun. It was great to see Mr. Peck kind of change his performance in the opening sequence. You got to see him portray afraid and stunned and shocked. And then you got to see him portray none of those things. So you got a good glimpse of how he carries on the tradition of performers playing Spock as someone not without emotions, but who is trying to restrain them. Everything about doing Trek as a slapstick comedy of errors was just absolutely brilliant. I think that every performer in it delivered. And if you want to get into Trek, if you've never seen anything before and you've heard about Strange New Worlds, I think Memento Mori and Spock Amok are great starting points.
Those are really good starting points. I would say probably bundle that with just simply the pilot episode, Strange New Worlds. You've got a 1, 2, 3 of episodes to really sort of get you settled in what the Trek world is. For me, Spock Amok, since you brought it up, I thought it actually showed sort of this relationship that will never be between Chapel and Spock, sort of the friend zone, if you will, of that. And I, in a way that I don't think we've ever seen in Trek before. And in that way, I have to give it kudos for doing something fresh and different.
Yeah.
The other side of things, though, of course, is episodes that we weren't so excited about.
Before we get to that, I do want to make a special mention to Jesse James Keitel playing Captain Angel in The Serene Squall. There are a lot of intelligent Trek films. You have mad scientists, you have evil Starfleet admirals, evil generals, evil whatever. Not very many villains have panache and humor. And she brought a lot to a character that didn't have a whole lot of screen time comparatively to the rest of the season. I was not expecting a villain that I want them to come back. I want them back at least once every season.
It was one of these strange things for me, at least, that I watched the episode, thought it was pretty good. And then I saw there was this whole thing about it outside of the episode. I was not aware of it, nor was I thinking about it in my first watch through it. For some people that were, had issues with it one way or another, or particularly one way, off. I think for everyone else, you know, it's fantastic that we get this kind of representation in Trek. I thought she was perfectly fine. And for those people that were excited to see her and knew this stuff outside of, I'm happy that it brought them a sense of belonging and connection and acknowledgement. For those who were upset with her casting, if this is about who she is outside of the show.
Was there a lot of backlash over Jesse James Keitel being in the show?
There were some people that were upset that a trans individual was cast in a Trek show or whatever, or she was not that this role, she wasn't that good or whatever. I didn't have a problem with any of it. It all felt right to me.
I was just about to say, if no matter who you are, what your background is, if you have a problem with Jesse James Keitel being a performer in Star Trek And again, regardless of any considerations of the performance, of the quality of it, of the writing, if that's your prime issue, just stop watching Star Trek right now. This probably isn't the franchise for you. There are many others that you can probably find. I know that Red Dawn has a limited number of his series and its installments, but you know, you might want to try there.
Or try some of the new shows that HBO will be trotting out in the near future.
Oh yeah, Property Brothers, go for it.
I think it's probably time to talk about some of the episodes that the writing or the idea, the notion of the episodes were a little off. And one of the things I have to say is that the beauty of the format for Strange New Worlds is if you have this episode and it's not something you're into, it's one episode. Skip over it. I have to say the episode that just for many reasons just didn't connect for me was The Elysian Kingdom. Okay, you want to do a fantasy episode and the general plot of the episode itself, I don't have a problem with. Problem I had with the episode was the execution. I'm glad that they gave Dr. Mbenga some closure with the connection with his daughter, which, you know, if you haven't watched Strange New Worlds and you're listening to this podcast, pause and, you know, watch the first couple of episodes and then come back. Now that you're back, I will let you know that it is a little strange to have their daughter in the transporter buffer, even though it's the medical transporter buffer for so long. There are many ethical questions about that that I'd like to figure out.
Right. I mean, it is a question of which form of living hell would you put your child in?
You know, the entity discovers that, you know, she feels the sadness from her or whatever, that she's trapped inside the system.
Right.
Why didn't you cryogenically freeze her at least?
Yeah.
I don't know why that choice was made other than just trying to give a unique sort of trouble or challenge to Dr. Mbenga. So I hope that in future seasons, they give him something that as a doctor, your ethics aren't more put in question.
For me, the entire arc about Dr. Mbenga having a daughter in the transporter buffer made me ask one big question. Does he not have a single relative on a planet? Were there no in-laws? Were there no brothers, no sisters, no aunts, no uncles, no grandparents? There's no one, not a godparent, not a good best friend who could have taken care of this child. Even if that child is in a pattern buffer, at least you're not in a ship that is likely to get attacked with torpedoes.
Exactly. There's so many different ways to have handled this. And it feels like this was something where we tried to build emotional resonance with a character. But in the end, I'm questioning as a doctor, their ethics. Like, yeah, they've made a big deal out of the ethics of genetic engineering this season. How about the ethics of sticking somebody, especially a child, in a transporter buffer? That's a story right there to me. And that also is the question I have with Trek is I really haven't seen an episode where people are struggling with an ethical decision. And in nowhere in this episode do we question the ethics of Dr. Mbenga. And to me, it's like, oh, we have all this fun and these characters playing out a character. And, you know, it's fun. It's cute and everything. In the end, when we're understanding more of what this all comes from, we're not left to grapple with any of the morals or the ethics of the situation. It's just all, it's kind of glossed over for, I love my daughter. She loves me. I want the best for my daughter. These very basic emotions. For me, Trek is about grappling with the ethics of choices of emotion and of logic. And that's what I feel like does not get touched on in this episode. This was the episode to touch on Mbenga's ethics.
Yeah.
And we didn't get that. We got this fun little romp as the audience. There was nothing for me to think about. This could have been, to me, if set up right, the conversation like Tuvix's. The ethics of putting your daughter in a transporter buffer for 10 years, maybe 5 years. Who knows how long she's been in there?
We have no idea.
And I just kept thinking to myself as the series went on from when we first revealed that his daughter was in the buffer. At what point is her being in the buffer going to cost someone their life?
Yeah. Like,
she's taking up space that you don't put people in.
Well, I was going to add, like, this is one of those episodes where, you know, the magical kingdom stuff I was fine with. It was fun to see, you know, the actors play against type, which was kind of really, I felt like, the purpose of all of that. But this was also the episode where you just wanted a Patrick Stewart or an Avery Brooks to just yell at him, what the hell were you thinking doing this in the first place? And as some of the points that we've raised, like the ethics of this, discussing this, it's never discussed. He just, his punishment is ostensibly that he loses his daughter, which begs the question, okay, well, what is the emotional tie-in for this character in the future? It felt like you based a big chunk of this character, who is a legacy character, You can't just write, you know, you can maybe say he goes back to an institution, fine, but you can't just kill him off as Dr. Ibenga. We know we see him later. So what is the emotional tie for him later on? It all begs the question, why did you make this choice over any other choice? Because here's the thing, make it not his daughter. Make it like a plant that he's trying to preserve or keep in a transporter. You know, Dr. Phlox used to do stuff like that on Enterprise. Like I have this weird thing. You know, make it anything other than his daughter, where we're questioning his ethics as a doctor, as a father, probably somewhat as a human being. My God, let's rack up the charges that we have now. We don't need a Patrick Stewart to say we have no law to fit your crime. There are several laws to fit your crime.
This was the episode that we were really set to sort of explore Dr. Ibenga.
Yeah.
But what we ended up doing was we told this little fun tale, and I still don't know anything about him other than he had a daughter now that was in a transporter buffer because of an illness, and he cares about his daughter. I know in the past people criticize, you know, this character, that character's entire role is that they care about another character. And that was right. Like the definition of their character. The funny thing here is the character that they care so much about, that's been sort of the defining characteristic of their character, is gone now from the show, essentially. Now you're left to define Ibenga. And I'm curious to see what they decided to do with it. But right now, Ibenga is a character that really we knew nothing about from the original series. There are reasons that they redid Chapel, and I'm fine with that. But with Ibenga, it's a clean slate. We're left with some quasi-generic stuff that could have been done in any science fiction show, to be honest. And even though we've touted the higher production value of recent Trek in the last 15 years, this to me felt like a regression to earlier times. Had this been an episode that they had staged back in the 60s when they had no money? Yeah, I'd understand why they put, you know, grass on a corridor. But you got a little bit more money nowadays. You have that holodeck, as they call it. You could easily make a generic planet and set this all there and put your green grass or whatever on that. And I would be perfectly accepting of something of that nature.
And it is disappointing in that episode because I feel like Babs Olosukun is a great actor who has and could deliver so much with that character, but it's the writing isn't there. My down vote for this season is actually half an episode.
Okay.
It's one I mentioned earlier. It's the Serene Squall. As I mentioned, I love Jesse James Keitel's performance. Her work is excellent. I love the writing and the performance with her and Ethan Peck and their interplay with each other. I love the writing on Spock's identity. I love that. Everything else having to do with the damn pirates, I hate it. I hated that joke. The only thing I liked about that joke was Rebecca Romijn saying, "Please stop," which I don't know if that was in character or out of character.
There's no telling. That episode did have some questionable dialogue choices. The idea of Pike commandeering a ship with a nautical wheel.
The nautical wheel. There were just so many. I felt like these were choices. This didn't just happen. These were bad choices. We did not need Pirates of the Caribbean in space. I didn't need the trope of the stupid pirates. And this is objectively bad writing. When a character says, okay, we're going to do this, so then you telegraph that to the audience. I just hate that. So then, okay, we're going to start a mutiny. I'm like, I cannot describe it as anything other than bad. Not good, not necessary. And I'm someone who has long said Star Trek could branch out in ways apart from the Federation by introducing space pirates. Well, not if you're going to do it with literally all the people who weren't cast as the side characters in Pirates of the Caribbean. It was just objectively bad. There was no reason for them to have taken that tack with it other than perhaps budget.
I still can't believe budget would be the reason that you would have a wheel on the ship.
A wheel, right? Just take one of the console things with the light of things you're not using, apply the, it just felt like very, very, very poorly chosen. And see, here's the thing. How many opportunities were there? I get that Orions and Ferengi can be expensive. Fine. But the crew of the Botany Bay didn't have a whole lot of extensive makeup. We don't know who these colonists, Captain Angel, were talking about. We don't know if Captain Angel is a part of a group of Vulcan extremists, which, to spoil the thing that also bothered me about that episode of the Serene Squall, the drop of bum 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 for the first time in canon since 88, I think.
89.
Cybok, Spock's other illegitimate half sibling,
What's weird about it is they obfuscated the reveal by giving him some sort of other name. And I don't know what the line was exactly supposed to be, if that was supposed to be an other name or a Vulcan name. But I remember in Star Trek V, when Spock first addresses Cybok, he says, "Qual se tu?" And I'm imagining that it may be Latin. It sounds like it might be Latin. Anybody listening that understands, let me know. But I thought perhaps that that was like some Vulcan name for him. To give him some other name that, other than what's been already established, to me just felt like you were hiding who this character is so we can do a reveal.
What rubbed me badly was, what did we do with that information? It was just dropped there. I'm like, okay, he exists. Was that, I get that he was sort of the MacGuffin of the episode to a certain extent, but why did you use him there? And then nothing for the rest of the season. It never came back up. It never came up of any relevance. Nobody ever asked him about it. Nobody ever said, really? You got a half brother? No.
I think the first 5 episodes of the season were extremely good, extremely strong overall. I think that the writing on the second half of the season felt a lot more up and down.
Yeah. Yeah. So. But I think that brings me to kind of like one overall thing of Strange New Worlds is that we're evaluating a season 1 of a Trek show. And on the whole, this one has gone, I would say, a lot smoother than most other season 1s of Trek shows. There's no All the Way Home. There's no, oh God, what's the one we don't speak of from TNG? Code of Honor. So there's been nothing that bad, I feel like. I mean, we had our issues with these episodes. I don't feel like any of them were quite that bad. So on the whole, I feel like this was a successful first season. And it is kind of difficult to evaluate just one season because we know that there are going to be more. We know that these stories are going to continue for a time. So it is worth it to allow them to see or allow them to work so that we can see how they're going to pay off some of these storylines. Like I said before, we know we're getting an Ortegas episode in the future. It's likely we're going to see a payoff of the Cybok Spock storyline and hopefully see the return of Captain Angel. Yeah, I do think that, you know, sometimes it does feel like you're evaluating the beauty of a season and not the flower it's going to turn into when it comes to early parts of Trek shows. And that, I just wanted to add that grain of salt over all the criticism of Strange New Worlds.
I think that wraps us up here with our time today, being able to talk about Strange New Worlds. And let us know in your comments in this episode and on Twitter, of course, what you thought the best episode or worst episodes were of Strange New Worlds and why. We'd love to hear what people are thinking about it.
And let us know if you thought that Captain Pike's hair was a character we failed to mention in this episode.
Yes, it did. So maybe that's a season 2 discussion. I'm Michael Stratigakis.
I'm Marshall Hopkins.
Live long and prosper, everybody.